Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, members of the diplomatic community and others, welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the director of the Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to today's event with the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Senator Maurice Payne. Ladies and gentlemen, it seems like every week we read another big story about a hack, the hacking of the parliament, the political parties, the Australian National University, and of course, the business world. None of us are immune from attempted attacks, and it's incumbent on all of us to do what we can to ensure those attacks are not successful. There are many international examples, of course, the North Korean hack on Sony, the worm that seriously affected, some people say crippled, the UK's NHS, and the alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 US election and the Brexit referendum. So it's happening all the time. It seems to be happening more often and with more deleterious consequences than ever. And therefore, it's very good timing for us to have a cyber month at the Institute. Later this month, we will be hosting Mike Burgess, the Director General of the Australian Signals Directorate, for a speech on Australia's offensive cyber capabilities. That will be an interesting one because generally we hear about other states' offensive capabilities and what we're doing to deter them. You don't often hear Five Eyes agency heads talking about their offensive capabilities. So that will be later this month. And today we're delighted to welcome Foreign Minister Maurice Payne and Ambassador for Cyber Affairs Toby Feakin to discuss Australia's international cyber engagement. Ladies and gentlemen, Maurice Payne entered Parliament in 1997 as a Senator for New South Wales. She served in a number of roles and, of course, most importantly, as Defence Minister from 2015 to 2018. And in that role, she oversaw the delivery of the 2016 Defence White Paper, in which the Turnbull government committed that by 2020-21, Australia would spend 2% of its GDP on defence, a very important and long overdue commitment. Maurice was appointed Foreign Minister in August of last year. Dr. Toby Feakin is Australia's first ambassador for cyber affairs, and Toby previously served as director of the National Security Program at ASPE from 2012 to 2016. We won't hold that against you, Toby. And he was a member of the independent panel of experts that helped to produce Australia's 2016 cyber security strategy. Ladies and gentlemen, in a minute, I'll invite Maurice Payne, Senator Payne, the Foreign Minister, to speak for about 20 minutes or so on the government's international cyber engagement strategy. Then Toby and the Minister will join me on stage for a conversation and a Q&A about this very important topic. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Minister.
Thank you very much, Michael, and it's a great pleasure to be back at Lowy and for your very warm welcome. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let me start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet here this afternoon and pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Let me welcome representatives of the Diplomatic Corps, many of the international partners with whom DFAT works and distinguished guests. I didn't realise it was Cyber Month at Lowy. I'm going to have to pop back and listen to Mike Burgess myself just to see what he's putting on the record. But I can assure you that the government is particularly well served by senior officials like Toby Feakin and Mike Burgess, who come to us with a wealth of experience and an absolute focus on our national security in terms of cyber. Ladies and gentlemen, basically we're talking about technology and how we can leverage it, how it shapes our future. And I see that as one of the greatest challenges and greatest opportunities of our lifetime. No one single piece of infrastructure is more important to our future and our prosperity and our freedom than the internet. It touches every part of our lives. It affects the way we work, the way we communicate with each other, how we express ourselves, how we run our homes, how we entertain ourselves. And it supports our democratic freedoms, freedoms of speech, of political thought, and of democratic choice. We all know that the rapid development of new technologies and increasingly universal access is delivering vast opportunities for both economic and social development. However, as our dependence on global networks grows, the potential risks, our vulnerabilities, also increase. I want to do a little bit of a stock take of where we are in 2019 and look at some of our future plans. As Michael adverted to, in April 2016, the Coalition Government launched the landmark National Cybersecurity Strategy to further develop our approach to these critical issues as individuals, businesses and government. And I'm pleased to say that many of the initiatives that were announced then have not only been established, but are now firmly part of the fabric of our nation's cybersecurity posture. While there was a focus on increasing our domestic resilience, the strategy also included a number of initiatives to help ensure that Australia had a strong and effective voice on these issues on the world stage. Chief amongst these was the establishment of a cyber ambassador to lead our engagement in advocating for a free, open and secure internet. Toby Feakin, well known to many of you here, was appointed later that year and has been a key part of Australia's effective engagement with the international community. It's been a great pleasure for me to work with Dr. Feakin since I was appointed to this role last year. While the internet has grown organically, without the direction or control of any one government, it doesn't mean that governments don't have an abiding interest in ensuring it remains a positive force for global development. However, not every nation shares Australia's view of how the internet should operate. Some countries see an open internet as a threat, and they advocate for far greater state control that would limit connectivity and stifle innovation and freedoms. But as Prime Minister Turnbull said at the launch in 2016, ensuring that the architecture and administration of cyberspace remains free of government domination or control is one of the key global strategic issues of our time. It's only become more pressing in the 3 years since 2016, and 2019 will be a pivotal year in shaping global views on these issues. It's therefore critically important for Australia to have a robust cybersecurity posture at home, not only to defend our citizens and business and institutions from cyber threats and interference, but to ensure we have a credible and effective voice on the world stage. The first step towards effective international advocacy on these issues was to clearly articulate our own perspective. So we launched Australia's International Cyber Engagement Strategy in 2017, one of the first of its kind in the world. Our strategy was and remains a strong statement about how our country approaches foreign and strategic policy aspects of cyberspace. It addresses a broad range of digital issues, but at its heart, it is simple. It sets out how Australia will advocate for and defend an open, free and secure cyberspace. That means Australia pursues policies that deliver security, stability and reliability, as well as opportunities afforded by confident, open and trusted cyber interactions. And the opportunities before us are significant, especially in the Indo-Pacific region. More than half of the world's internet users are in the Indo-Pacific, but less than half the region is online. The scale of the untapped opportunity in our region is immense. Across the region, increasing connectivity is driving access to health services, opening new education opportunities, and of course, facilitating global commerce. And this in turn drives opportunities for Australia. Connectivity is opening up new markets to both Australian businesses and regional entrepreneurs who were previously constrained by the tyranny of distance or reliance on paper-based transactional commerce. Digital services, currently worth $6 billion, are Australia's fourth largest export sector. And research estimates that Australia's digital exports could more than double by 2030, enabling almost $200 billion of economic value in our domestic economy. That's why we are leading international discussions in the World Trade Organization to make sure the rules guiding international digital trade are fit for purpose in the 21st century. And another key part of Australia's international engagement is to ensure the benefits of connectivity are realised across our region, including in the Pacific, and that all nations have an understanding of those challenges to which I referred. For example, Australia is majority funding undersea telecommunications cables to Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. This includes funding for a domestic network in the Solomon Islands, linking Honiara with Auckie in Malaita Province, Noro in Western Province, and Taro in Choiseul Province. The Coral Sea cable system will deliver faster, cheaper, and more reliable communications infrastructure, affording both countries significant economic and development benefits. Since signing a $137 million contract with Vocus in June of last year, construction of the Coral Sea cable and the Solomon Islands domestic network is indeed well underway. Last month, together with Solomon Islands caretaker Prime Minister Rick Ho, I took part in a slightly damp, groundbreaking ceremony in Honiara at the site of the Campbell Cable Landing Station, which will soon connect the 4,700-kilometre international cable with the domestic network. I have to say, if you're standing in Honiara and you're talking about delivering an internet capacity that cable will deliver, the anticipation, the excitement, absolutely palpable amongst young people looking forward to being able to study in a much more effective way. Businesses looking forward to being able to do business in a much more effective way. Government looking forward to being able to deliver to citizens in a much more effective way. And as at the 6th of March last week, the manufacture of the cable itself was 92% complete. So 92% of 4,700 kilometres of cable. Installation of the cable will start to take place from June of this year, with it scheduled to be ready for service by the end of 2019. And we're working to ensure that nations in our region have the capability to defend these networks. This is occurring both via discussions through regional fora, including ASEAN, and through our bilateral programs. I also wanted to note that in September of last year, at the Nauru Pacific Island Forum meeting, member nations also affirmed the importance of cybersecurity in the Boy Declaration, focused on both protections and opportunities. In 2016, we started with an initial investment of $4 million in our national cybersecurity strategy. And since then, our cyber cooperation has supported over 40 projects across ASEAN and the Pacific, working with over 25 delivery partners, and some of you have been able to join us today. Last year, the government funded the construction of a national cybersecurity centre in Papua New Guinea, and I was proud to officially open it in Port Moresby in November with Papua New Guinea Prime Minister Sam Basil and Justin Tachenko. It played a vital role in protecting the APEC meeting of 2018, and we continue to build on our cybersecurity partnership with Papua New Guinea to make sure the centre is a sustainable national initiative that protects Papua New Guinea's government and its sovereignty from cyber threats. Meeting the team there in Port Moresby and seeing their deep interest in their work was very, very gratifying. Next month in the Solomon Islands, the winner of the Tech for Development Challenge will be selected from 51 ideas to use digital technology to enhance educational and employment outcomes for the country's youth. These programs complement the government's investment in telecommunications infrastructure in Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, ensuring that our near neighbours are able to benefit from an open, free and secure cyberspace. We're also engaging with businesses across the region to strengthen cyber resilience. For example, we are working closely with Qantas to improve the cybersecurity awareness of airlines from across Southeast Asia. We've worked with the Commonwealth Bank to translate their customer advice on cybersecurity into Bahasa Indonesian. And the government has translated into Thai, Vietnamese and again Bahasa Indonesian and made freely available ASD's Essential 8 Cybersecurity Steps for Companies in all of those languages, which can protect users from a significant number of cyber threats and risks. We are eager to build on our success so far, and today I'm very pleased to announce that the Australian government is committing a further $10 million to this program, increasing our total investment to over $48 million. This is going to enable us to cooperate with more governments and businesses across the Indo-Pacific, supporting the regional prosperity that flows from the spread of safe connectivity. We're looking forward to working with more partners to deliver meaningful impact on the ground. But 3 years after the launch of our cybersecurity strategy, it is, as I said, timely to take stock of where we are in 2019. The good news is that through the government's effort, both at home and abroad, through the initiatives I've outlined, that there is far greater awareness of the issues around dealing in cyberspace. In Australia, our businesses, our institutions and individuals are improving their own cyber hygiene, and we're getting better at detecting and identifying cyber vulnerabilities. But we do all know that there is still much work to be done. Thanks to our advocacy efforts, there is also a deepening understanding amongst regional partners of the need for the establishment of and observation of global rules and norms in cyberspace. However, over the past 3 years, we have seen an increase in the willingness of states and non-states actors to use the internet for malicious and indiscriminate ends. Certainly in the past 3 years, more countries have developed cyber capabilities and demonstrated a willingness to use them. These capabilities have the potential to increasingly threaten our economic and our national security. In May of 2017, as Michael referred to, we saw the WannaCry ransomware incident cause global damage, affecting 150 countries and causing serious disruption of the health system in the United Kingdom. This indiscriminate, state-sponsored activity is just one example of the concerning activities that have prompted Australia and a number of our international partners to begin to name and shame, if you like, that conduct, or to reject that behaviour, as we did when we attributed responsibility for WannaCry to North Korea. Since then, we've worked with like-minded partners and we've publicly attributed malicious cyber activity to Russia, to Iran, and most recently, at the end of last year, to China. We have also seen deeply concerning attempts to undermine democratic processes, the highly publicised activities around the 2016 United States elections, allegations of interference in France's 2017 presidential elections, and allegations of interference in the Ukraine. Most recently, the cyber intrusion into the Australian Parliament House computer network, the networks of the Liberal, Labor, and National political parties, is a stark example and a timely reminder of the current cyber threat landscape. We committed in 2016 to being transparent through our cybersecurity strategy, which is why the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, formally declared the state-sponsored intrusion on the floor of the Parliament. Attribution is a difficult, technical, time-consuming process, and we continue to investigate who was responsible for those attacks on our democratic institutions as a matter of priority. Attribution brings welcome public attention to these issues, brings further attention, potentially embarrassment for the offending actor. We stand by our commitment to being transparent about cyber incidents and our cyber strategy. So in that spirit, today, I'm pleased to release the first update of our international cyber engagement strategy, which hopefully you all have a copy of. It outlines the progress we have made since its publication in 2017 and where and how we will continue to advocate for free, open and secure cyberspace and for change where needed. We do this because we know that through transparency grows trust and predictability. Confidence in cyberspace is built through bringing the discussion of risks, threats, and policy into the light of open debate. That's what Australia has done and will continue to do. By updating our strategy, we are also fostering mature and productive conversations in the international community. This position will guide our engagement in international discussions of stability in cyberspace. It'll provide a marker of Australia's thought leadership and active approach to working with international partners for mutually beneficial collective gains. The most recent attack on our own democratic institutions serves as a reminder that we cannot be complacent about the risks to our sovereignty and the pressing need for all nations to determine and stand by an agreed set of international rules and norms in cyberspace. It is now so fundamental to modern life that serious cyber incidents could, if mismanaged, escalate to a form of conflict between states. There is a behavioural grey zone in cyberspace that, unfortunately, more actors appear willing to exploit. And that is why we need greater clarity on the application of international law in cyberspace. As I said earlier, 2019 will be a pivotal year in the development of the rules of the road in cyberspace. Two key UN bodies will meet this year to further strengthen the international framework that governs cyberspace. The UN group of governmental experts, known as the UNGGE, consists of members chosen by the United Nations to provide broad geographic representation. The UNGGE has evolved as technology and cyber participation have increased. It has made landmark agreements on international security and cyberspace in its five incarnations since being established in 1998. We were very proud to chair the UNGGE in 2013 when it agreed that existing international law applied in cyberspace. Then in 2015, the UNGGE agreed to 11 norms of responsible state behaviour in cyberspace. We have nominated to be a member of the sixth group commencing this year, and if successful, we are very eager to advance cybersecurity and to further clarify these rules and norms to reduce this grey zone. The second UN group is called the Open-Ended Working Group. It's a newer body, open to all UN members to discuss international law and norms of state behaviour in cyberspace. And we are also committed to being an active and practical member of that working group as part of our close cooperation on these issues. These two groups will have a considerable influence this year on the future of international cyber stability. Australians will be actively working with these two bodies to ensure the internet remains free and open and secure so that we can continue to reap the benefits that offers. And we are urging like-minded nations to throw their support and resources behind these international efforts that will build trust and transparency. Ladies and gentlemen, Australia's international cyber engagement is world-leading. Our continued advocacy for our vision of a cyberspace that balances openness and freedom and security is important. Australia is taking action, working with our partners and building the capacity of our region to ensure we preserve an inclusive, open, free and secure cyberspace that benefits Australia, the Indo-Pacific region and the world. I'm very proud of the contribution that Australia is making to the secure end of the spectrum, actively responding to malicious cyber behaviour, empowering our cybersecurity agencies and their capabilities, and contributing to international security with our partners. I'm equally proud of the work that we do to spread the concepts of open and free. In politics, there is a phrase that goes something along the lines of, not until you are bored with saying whatever your message is, can you presume that those to whom you are speaking might be listening or hearing it. So we can't say it often enough. Secure, open, and free. That is what we stand for. That is what we represent. That is what we advocate. From digital trade to human rights, cyberspace has enabled enormous social and economic advancements. And Australia is working on all fronts to ensure that Australians and the international community can enjoy the fullest extent of technology's potential, far into the future, and enjoy it with trust and with confidence. Thank you very much for the opportunity to make a few remarks to provide that stock take this afternoon, and I look forward to our conversation, Michael.
Well, Minister, thank you very much and for that Stocktake, and I'm sure everybody here would associate ourselves with the goal that you've set of a secure, open and free internet. And welcome also Toby Feakin. And perhaps, Minister, with your permission, I might go first to the Ambassador, as he hasn't had a chance yet to speak. Toby, the Minister put on record the achievements of the strategy, but she also alluded to the fact that things are not necessarily going in a positive direction, as I think Emperor Hirohito said towards the end of the Second World War. To you're at the
another metaphor.
you're at the coalface of the cyber wars, if you like. Does it noticeably feel that it is getting hotter and more lethal? Because just as an observer, a reader of the newspaper, without any sort of security clearance, that's how it feels to me.
Thank you. Let me talk about that from a diplomatic point of view. Absolutely, it's getting warmer, and the conversations that we have to have with partners, you have a very different view of how the internet should look and feel in the future. There is no doubt that we're in a hotly contested area, and I think the Minister mentioned that in her speech, these various different bodies that are being set up through the UN, where these conversations are going to be progressed and move forward. But we have these conversations through so many different organisations as well, be they ICANN, where the future of the internet's being grappled with. And yes, there are countries that have a very state-centric view of how these things should be done, with a very different view of how human rights is interpreted in the online space. And to be frank, how our societies would function as a consequence of that. So I think we do live in an incredibly contested moment. And you allude to the fact that there is also a change, if you like, in the cyber environment in terms of what's going on technically. And part of that is down to the fact that we are more transparent and we are more open in terms of saying what's going on, because we feel some of these behaviors do have to stop. But part of it is also that increased numbers of countries now have these capabilities and don't utilize them with the similar kind of framework that Mike Burgess will no doubt talk about when he makes his speech in the coming weeks.
And let me ask you just a follow-up on this question of attribution that the Minister talked about. It's a very interesting development, and as the Minister alluded, in December, for example, we, along with a number of other countries, attributed a campaign of cyber-enabled commercial intellectual property theft to a group acting on behalf of the Chinese Ministry of State Security. Can you talk us through, Toby, how does the attribution process work? What are the basis on which we make a decision to attribute? Does Australia ever attribute by itself? Does it only ever attribute with other partners? Tell us how that process works, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be interesting to get a number of hands. I mean, who would guess in the audience that attribution was done just via technical means? Hands up. Well, that's good. That's a good starting point. Then we're certainly changing the discussion, because often there is this sense that you need 100% absolute information from a technical point of view, because we are dealing with computers, essentially. And that isn't actually the case. When we're looking at attribution, we'll look across all of the different equities that decision requires. So, of course, we'll want an intelligence assessment of certainty. If we're attributing with another country, what degree of damage or harm has that caused Australia, the Australian economy, the Australian government? What kind of policy environment are we in? And then we essentially meet across all of those equities and all of those different government partners, and then make a decision based from that point. And obviously, you know, the Foreign Minister plays an incredibly important role within that, because of obviously a lot of these issues then boil down to sensitivities with the bilateral relationship.
And Minister, you mentioned the attack on Australia's democratic institutions, but I think, if I'm correct, the Prime Minister referred to the culprit in that case as a sophisticated state actor. He didn't attribute it to a particular country. So why haven't we attributed that attack yet?
Well, I think, as I said when I was speaking, Michael, that is still being examined, because it is so complex and has significant technical elements. So that is work that I don't think government would ever want to rush, nor would intelligence agencies or technical specialists and professionals. So that is still being considered. But from a government's point of view, we've taken that very seriously, briefed the political parties appropriately to make sure that they are all informed and aware of potential vulnerabilities and able to address those.
Does that mean when the investigation is complete, we will attribute that attack?
Well, I think, as we were saying earlier, each of these circumstances is very different, and this is different again. And they assessments are made based on the nature of the circumstances, and I wouldn't like to say at this point in time whether that will ultimately be the case or not. That will ultimately be a decision for government.
Let me ask you one or two questions about 5G, if I may. I know it's not what you discussed today, but it's obviously a closely related issue. We're seeing a divergent response from like-minded countries, at least that's the way it seems to me, in the sense that Australia, New Zealand and the United States have said that Huawei cannot participate in building our domestic 5G networks, but we at least have seen reporting in the FT, I think, and elsewhere that some in the British intelligence establishment are not necessarily sold on the idea that Huawei should be excluded. So can I ask you, Minister, again, because this is one of these questions that if you don't have access to security classifications, it's hard sometimes to make a judgment. Why should a company like Huawei be ruled out of providing that 5G technology in a country like Australia?
So I think what we have been very careful to emphasise, Michael, is that we have taken the strongest advice from intelligence agencies in this country, the strongest technical advice as to the best way to protect Australia's national interests in the establishment of a 5G network here. As a member of the National Security Committee, that's the advice upon which I rely. We took a long time to consider the implications and to come to that decision. And we're appropriate and possible being prepared to share that information in appropriate circumstances, not publicly, in intelligence terms. So we are resolved on the position that Australia has taken. Other countries will make their own decisions, but for us to protect Australia's national security, to ensure that the priorities of any business involved in our communications network are to place first Australia's protection and Australia's national security, that is the decision we've made.
One, you may well have seen the tweet by President Trump in late February where it's a bit hard to read it, but he seemed to offer an olive branch to Beijing in relation to Huawei, and he said this: I want the United States to win through competition, not by blocking out currently more advanced technologies. Obviously, that would be extremely awkward if the United States were to change its policy on 5G after we've made our decision. How did you read that communication from the President?
I think the engagement between our intelligence agencies has been very important in our decision-making process, and we'll continue to prioritise that. I think it's important, though, also to recognise that every country will make a sovereign decision. They'll make their own decisions based on their own national interests. The one Australia has made is not directed at any one company or two companies or five companies or eight companies. It's directed at protecting our national interest.
Yes, Toby. Yes, please.
Quite a G question, because I think, you know, it's something that obsesses a lot of time now in this position and between countries bilaterally. I'm sure, Minister, you've been asked this question more times than you can care to remember. And again, I think, you know, let's put it into context. A lot of people would probably imagine it just means another number on your phone. So instead of four, you'll see five. It's not the case. It's a comprehensive infrastructure change in the way that we do business. And the way that our societies will function. It's so, you know, it's not just that extra number, it's about how all of your IoT devices will communicate with each other, how any driverless car will function in the future. So it's one of the most fundamentally important infrastructure decisions a country will make. Mm. And so the decision that Australia has made, as the Minister absolutely rightly said, it's not about a particular company, it's about making decisions around that technology and what you're comfortable with. As a country, we decided we couldn't take a decision where you could separate out parts of that infrastructure and take a risk mitigation approach. for national security reasons and, you know, for the security of that infrastructure in the future, it was important to show that we could make a decision around where companies' linkages led back to, what kind of policies they held that were in close association with a given country where they were based. So the decisions around it were more about accountability and transparency again, which is something which is so, so important. We need to be able to trust that infrastructure and all the things that we then go forward to deliver on the back of it. So whilst, yes, we sit and watch sovereign decisions, which they all are, I think Australia's decision has been admired around the world, and certainly frequent requests through my position, and I'm sure through yours, Minister, is, well, how did you make that decision and what's some of that information? And we've been quite comfortable with sharing that.
Toby, you may have seen a speech by the former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull last week, I think, where he was talking about some of these questions and explaining it to a British audience. And one point I thought he made that was very interesting was he noted the fact that there is no... given the historic advances that countries like the UK and Australia and the United States have made in Wi-Fi technology and so on, how unfortunate it is that none of these like-minded countries have a carrier that seems to be able to provide the 5G technology that we're all going to need. Why is that? I think am I right that there's only four companies, I think Malcolm was saying, that are in a position to provide it, two are European continent and two are from China. Why do you think it is that none of these very innovative countries in the Anglophone world have succeeded in this realm?
Interesting. I was chuckling because there's a fair few conversations that I've been involved in when the Prime Minister was the Prime Minister on that front.
So you've got a good answer.
Well, yeah, and I'll have to duck some of those conversations.
I'm entirely sure you can share it all. But...
yeah, exactly. So I'll allude to it but not share, if that's okay. That's not very transparent, is it? So I think one of the biggest questions, exactly, I've got to be super careful now. So one of the interesting things, one of the questions that's often asked is about price point, okay? And the fact that some of the companies in China have taken decisions to make huge investments in this area of technology. And I guess for the policy wonks out there, go and read any of the kind of policy documents that the Chinese government puts around this and you start seeing why. It's about being technologically at the front of every single curve. However, price point is one issue. It could be cheap to begin with, but the thing is, with the other companies, and I have to be careful because I'm not working for those companies and I can't advocate for them, but actually the through life cost of the kind of, if you like, assurance and trust that brings actually levels itself out in the longer term. So you're right, there are some particularly Scandinavian countries who have capability in this area, and they are making rapid advancements in terms of promoting their proposition globally now. And we're certainly seeing that shift dramatically from even 6 to 12 months ago, that race is proceeding apace.
Let me ask one more question, then I want to go to the audience and give them an opportunity to ask a question to either the Minister or the Ambassador. Minister, you mentioned also the undersea internet cable that's being built between Australia, PNG and the Solomons. The history of that, of course, is that in late 2016, the Seoul's government signed a deal with Huawei to lay a cable to Australia. And subsequently, the Australian government agreed with Honiara to take over and I think fund about 2/3 from memory of the project and also to connect it to PNG. Why did Australia make that decision?
Well, I think we've been very clear in recent years, particularly, and the Pacific Step Up, which the Prime Minister announced and built on at the end of last year, is reflective of that, that we want to be the security partner of choice in the region, that we have capacity to support our regional neighbours, our Pacific family, particularly in infrastructure development. And the natural progression of that from this investment to now is the announcement of the Australia Infrastructure Financing Facility for the Pacific, which we announced also at the end of last year. As I said in my remarks, being in Honiara to actually be at the sod turn for the landing site of the cable was really a tangible reminder of what a difference that this will make for communities across our region, whether it's in Papua New Guinea or in the Solomon Islands. So Australia has the capacity to assist. We've been working extremely closely with these countries over many, many years. I personally visited the Solomon Islands a number of times during the Ramsi period, a different form of support and engagement, but I think this is a reflection of the maturity of the relationship and also a contribution, a really important infrastructure contribution that we can make in the region. The most excited of all of the people I think that I met were young Solomon Islanders. Who are so much looking forward to being able to work and to study in a different way that we completely take for granted. It's also timely in terms of this discussion to contemplate how, for example, the Solomon Islands Electoral Commission will run their election at the beginning of April. They will have something like 1,200 polling places across the islands of the Solomon Islands nation. We will send some observers to that, but we can't even scratch the surface, really, in the process of observing an election like that. With an IT capacity that will be changed completely by this cable, their election after this will be a totally different ballgame. So I think they are tangible manifestations of how Australia can engage and support. We have the Australian Electoral Commission there now working with the Solomon Islands Electoral Commission in the delivery of this upcoming ballot. But by the time we get to the one beyond this, it will be a completely different world, and that is real change, real advancement and real development.
All right. Thank you, Minister. So let me... there's a number of hands that are up. I'll go first. I saw Jamie Tarabay from the New York Times.
Good morning. Thank you. Well, good afternoon. Sorry, I'm a little jet-lagged. I have two...
Permanent state. Permanent state.
I apologise. I have two questions. And separately, I have a million questions about Syria, but we can talk about that another time. Two questions. So regarding 5G and Huawei, Australia's made this decision, which is, you know, how do you then marry your national security interests when you are dealing with countries that have these agreements like PNG to allow Huawei to set up their 5G network? How do you enforce security barriers to maintain the integrity of the Australian sort of communications network? And my second question, oh my God, it's coming to me. Yeah, what? On attribution. So the attribution was unique in and of itself. With the thought process and coming out and sort of naming a sophisticated state actor, and then following on from Michael's question about what you do then, will you name, what will the consequences of that be? And are you considering, what kind of responses are you considering? It'd be really nice to sort of get a sense of your thought process there. Thank you.
I don't think I'm going to spitball that with you. That's a decision for a sovereign government, and we'll make that in due course. But in relation to how we will interact with our counterparts, neighbours, allies, whatever category they fall into, is as we usually do. We manage differences in approach, differences in technologies, differences in platforms all the time across our closest of allies and partners and more broadly on a daily basis. So we have effective working relationships built over many, many years by posts in country, by Defence, Foreign Affairs and Trade and Home Affairs officials who work carefully between our counterparts. That is business as usual for us.
As I spoke of, you know, these 40 different projects that we're running around the region, a core focus of that is around cybersecurity awareness, threat awareness. So all these decisions are being made on a sovereign basis. But what we can do is we can assist countries in understanding risks and potential responses for them on a daily basis, underpinning their digital economy futures, understanding the risks that might be posed, assisting them in upskilling their ability to respond to cyber criminal activity within their borders as well.
One of the things I referred to in my remarks was the decision of the Pacific Island Forum to specifically refer to cybersecurity in the Boyd Declaration, security declaration of that meeting. That is a step change in terms of issues under consideration, and that I think marries well with the work that Toby does, which goes from, you know, cyber boot camps to the most sophisticated technical engagements around the region and more broadly.
Thank you. My name is Annie Edwards from the Institute for Global Peace and Sustainable Governance. My question is directed to the minister. What are the connections or implications, if there are any, on the Chinese foreign investment policy and the Australian Foreign Influence Transparency Scheme? I believe there are about 9 signatories to this scheme at the moment.
We took a decision in 2017-18 to make sure that in terms of foreign influence, separate from foreign investment, in terms of foreign influence, we are protecting Australia's national interests. We legislated for that through the parliamentary process, and I think that was a message from the government that for anyone who seeks to interfere in and to intervene in the democratic processes in Australia, that is not something any elected government in this country is prepared to support, no matter where they come from. And we have certainly seen, as I said in my remarks, a number of examples in recent times internationally of efforts by state actors and non-state actors to interfere in other countries. We are protecting ourselves, and that is what the citizens of Australia expect us to do. It is the first obligation of government to protect our citizens and to protect our country. In terms of foreign investment more broadly, we enthusiastically welcome foreign investment in Australia and have very strong relationships across the international panoply of businesses and countries who have engaged with us over a very long period of time. That continues to be the case. Some of those, because of the nature of those investments, are assessed, for example, by the Foreign Investment Review Board. You would always expect that to be the case because, again, the role of the government is to consider our national interests.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daniel from the Fiji Consulate here in Sydney, and thank you, Dr. Fully Love and the Lowy Institute team for hosting another great event and for the Minister and Ambassador for their respective remarks. Regrettably, my question is not about the Pacific, but rather the role of technology and cyber companies like Google and Facebook in this space. Google, for instance, just announced that they won't be allowing any kind of political ads on their platform in Canada because they simply cannot comply with the now stringent verification process enshrined in Canadian law. So I'd just be curious to hear your thoughts about what the role of these companies will be, particularly given that we have both state and federal elections coming up here in Australia.
Take them on, Minister, if you like.
I was going to say, I'm sure they'll be only good.
Yeah. We have a really productive relationship with those companies. I mean, it has to be a two-way dialogue continually and has been through election task forces that have been set up through the government and will continue to be through the electoral cycle. I think we do appreciate, and actually interestingly, I was just with one of my counterparts in San Francisco, who's the Danish tech ambassador, and he's actually based in Silicon Valley to ensure that there is diplomatic representation with the big providers, be they Google, Facebook, or whatever that might be, because that conversation does need maturing at that top level. And I think wherever you sit, be it in the private sector and government, there's an acknowledgement of that. But in relation to the conversations that take place, that's a continual cycle.
Can I ask you, Minister, just a question following on from that? You mentioned the attack on our parliament and on our political parties. Should Australians feel nervous, as the questioner asked? We have a federal election coming up probably in May. We have state election in New South Wales and other elections coming up. And, of course, we've watched with dismay, really, the evidence that's emerged of Russia seeking to interfere in the presidential election and in other elections. How confident can Australians feel that our institutions are properly protected from outside interference from other countries?
And again, back to the first role of government being to protect Australia's national interests and to protect Australian people and entities from that sort of effort externally. But it's fair to say, and I don't think I would be exaggerating, and Toby will correct me if I am, but it requires constant vigilance. It's a full-time job, not just here, but globally. So whether those who seek to exploit vulnerabilities in systems are doing it for profit, doing it for disruption, doing it malevolently for other reasons, It is a case of constant vigilance. So our agencies, our intelligence agencies, our technical specialists, companies, which have a very important role to play from the corporate side of this, are a key part of making sure that we are taking every step to protect our systems, to protect our processes. We have been fortunate in Australia to date, but that does not mean that we rest on our laurels. So in relation to upcoming elections, whether they're being run by state electoral commissions or the Australian Electoral Commission, this is a core part of everyday business, ensuring those processes are protected from external influence and interference. And it is, of course, also something that we discuss across the region. There are a lot of elections in the region in the coming year. In fact, I think I've counted, we're almost up to a dozen across the region. So it is a matter of great focus for us. We have expertise in Australia, which we can share more broadly, but our first focus is on protecting ourselves.
Toby, on that subject, what role does deterrence have to play in stopping these sorts of these adversaries getting their hands dirty in our internal affairs? For example, we know now that during the presidential campaign, of course, the Americans became aware of some of the actions of Russia. We know through extensive reporting that President Obama shirt-fronted President Putin, to use a phrase, and told him to stop it. But obviously he didn't stop it. And there have been a lot of criticisms of the weakness of the Obama administration's approach. A lot of analysts saying, for example, that we should have, that Western countries should have used its information to really impose a cost on President Putin, perhaps a personal cost. And you've seen there's lots of reporting to the effect that they might have disclosed the fact and the source of various ill-gotten gains that he allegedly holds himself, for example. So how much, what role does deterrence have? I mean, you can stop, you can put up all the walls, but at a certain point, don't you have to say to the people who are interfering with you, if you continue to do this, that there is going to be a cost that you pay?
That is an incredibly live discussion in the international environment right now. And you mentioned, both the minister and yourself, Michael, mentioned some of the attributions that have taken place. And I think what's notable about them are the number of countries that are now attributing jointly. It's fair to say, I think, if you look back at the history of the US-China discussion, if you go back to 2014-15, when the discussions between Xi and Obama took place in California, there was an understanding that there was so much bilaterally they could do, but to actually really reshape behavior in cyberspace, it had to be done jointly. So one thing that we've done very actively is try to create more of a community of countries who are willing to come along on the journey. And that's not without its complexities of sharing intelligence and information and, making sure that you're all aligned and timed at the right moment. But that, of course, is one step in a process. And there is a very live discussion, again, in the international environment about, well, are there other costs that you can impose on countries to try and squeeze their operating space? The Americans, obviously, are very forward-leaning in this regard and for many years have looked to actually pinpoint individuals within specific organizations, be they Ministry of State Security, be they the GRU in Russia. If you like, reshape that misnomer that attribution is impossible, because that still seems to exist in many conversations, and say, well, look, you can choose to do these things, but actually we can pinpoint who you are and we can understand who you are and impose a cost on you as an individual, as you as an organization, and then you as a nation. It's a process at the moment, though. So it's a work in progress, and we're working as hard as we can to change what's going on, because these UN bodies that are about to meet this year, they have a really focused, important role in stating what, the rules are around that gray space. Anything below the level of armed conflict, that's where the gray space exists. That's what's being exploited mercilessly by a whole range of countries. But let's be frank, if you go back to the 2013 UNGGE and talk about international law in the entirety of the UN Charter applying in cyberspace, that would include elections. So we've already agreed to that, yet that's something that's already been, you know, we've seen in the past has been pushed on. So it's a good question, and it's something that is probably one of the most live topics that we're dealing with through this position and cross-government.
And one of the reasons for that, if I may say, is because each case is absolutely unique. So even in the amount of time that I've been in this role, I've not seen a case which you can say like equals like. They're completely different, manifest in different ways, they're discovered in different ways, they're prosecuted in different ways, and I think that really gives you some idea, or hopefully gives you some idea of the complexity of the examination that a government has to go through before it makes a decision for this.
My name's Sarah Pavlard. I'm the CEO of a consultancy called Adroita. My question is really for the Minister. Given the policy is essentially to maintain a secure, open and free internet, and we've also discussed today the heating up of the threat environment, is there sufficient investment in offensive and defensive cyber capabilities forecast in the integrated investment plan that is being run by Defence? And is that IIP sufficiently agile to meet the potential threat to cyberspace in terms of that open, free and secure environment?
If I can just indulgently say, I love the fact that you've asked a question about the IIP, the Integrated Investment Program that underpinned the 2016 Defence White Paper, to which I'm personally very attached. Therefore, it's a very good question. I think if the person sitting here instead of me was Major General Marcus Thompson, then, for example, he would enthusiastically advocate his cause for the work that he and his unit within the ADF are doing, working closely with the Australian Signals Directorate, which, of course, has been stood up separately as a statutory agency in its own right, with increased independence and staffing to exactly address the sorts of challenges that we are facing going forward. Would all of the components that fit within that space, offensive and defensive cyber, would they all say they want more resources and they want more people? I think the answer is yes. But we work constantly to review the challenges, to review the shifts and changes in the international environment to make sure that we are responsive and that we are supporting the professionals in the way that we need to and providing the resourcing that we need to. Just after ASD stood up separately on 1 July last year, I went to Russell to an all-staff event. That doesn't happen very often in the Australian Signals Directorate. To say that there is a level of commitment and enthusiasm for the task that they do would be an understatement. I wouldn't be selling them strongly enough. They are hugely professional. They are changing and they're working hard to make sure that that change makes them as responsive and capable as they can be. So I'm confident that we review regularly, that we support the advice and the feedback provided to us by their leaders, people like Mike Burgess, who you will see here very shortly, people like Major Marcus Thompson, people like Alistair McGibbon at the ACSC, all of those entities backed in the international context by our own cyber ambassador are part of how we are addressing this challenge, and I think we have a very significant focus.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. I apologise that I didn't get to everybody. There was a lot of interest today, but as Marie says, bide your time. We have other cyber speakers coming. Before I thank my speakers, let me just mention two forthcoming events. First of all, later this week, my colleague Alex Oliver will host a very interesting discussion between Gareth Evans, one of Maurice's predecessors as Foreign Minister, and Michael Kirby, the former Justice of the High Court, on Australia's role in nuclear proliferation and disarmament. And then, as we've discussed, on the 27th of March, we'll be hosting the DG of ASD, Mike Burgess. There's an enormous amount of interest in that event. So if you're interested in coming to that, please register immediately. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Ambassador Toby Feakin and Senator Maurice Payne for coming along, for making themselves available on a very interesting topic. It's not an easy one to address publicly. I appreciate the transparency that they've shown in answering my questions and your questions. It's a very interesting topic indeed, and I'd like to thank both of them, and let me thank in particular the minister. She's been here as minister now a number of times. We always appreciate her presence. One of our questioners complained about jet lag, but of course, no one can beat the Australian Foreign Minister of the day in terms of jet lag. So thank you for coming and for being as articulate as ever, despite any jet lag you might have. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking them.